Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, the good art of bad people. What do we do about that? I'll bet many of us have recently asked ourselves some version of this question. He's a jerk, a predator, a criminal. Does that mean I have to disavow the movie, the music, the literature that he creates? I wrestled with this pretty openly about Sherman Alexie in a thread essay earlier this winter. Numerous women, including some young Native American writers, have accused him of sexual harassment, and I believe them, but I love his work. So does that mean that his wonderful poetry and prose is now off limits to me? That feels like a significant loss, too. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott wrote about Woody Allen in January and observed this: when we talk about the behavior of artists and our feelings about them, we're inevitably dealing with much messier, murkier, subjective issues. So that's the essence of the conversation, and I hope you'll join in. How are you handling the art, the movies, the books, the television made by people who have been accused and or admitted to sexual harassment and assault? Have you forever set aside Bill Cosby's comedy, Kevin Spacey's movies, the work of Russell Simmons and Sherman Alexie and Charlie Rose? How are you dealing with that in your own life? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Claire Dieterer is with us. She's a writer and an author of Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning. And she'll actually be at Majors in Quinn on May 9th at 7 o'clock. Claire, welcome. I wish you were in studio, but it's good to have you on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Alyssa Rosenberg is going to join us in a few minutes. She's an opinion writer for The Washington Post, and she's been writing about this as well. Claire, I read your piece from the Paris Review in November, and you had this weird experience. It must be because you're working on another book about this. You were researching Roman Polanski, and you were taking note of his, is it an alleged crime or a conviction of sexual assault of a preteen girl?
He was in the midst of sort of being convicted when, and he was released from being held and actually fled the country in the midst of being convicted.
As you researched him, you found yourself ever more captivated by his movies, yes?
Yeah, so I actually started my career as a film critic, and I've loved Roman Polanski's film since I was a college student, which is quite a long time ago. And I was writing about him in a totally different context for my most recent book, Love and Trouble. I was writing about sort of 70s culture, and he became this important, almost like totemic figure around certain issues I was writing about.
Mm-hmm.
I finished writing the book, but I was left with the fact that I still loved the films. And now I'd been researching him for several years, and I sort of knew the ins and outs of all the crimes he had done.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Chinatown, Repulsion, Knife in the Water, and Rosemary's Baby, these were still films I watched over and over. And not only that, but I watched the new films, too. He's still making terrific films that don't get a wide release in America.
Yeah.
So nobody knew about his crimes better than I did. And I really identified with the experiences of his victim. And yet, the films were great. And I found myself watching them and even paying for them. And I was fascinated by that dynamic between exactly what we're talking about, what he had made, which was inarguably, to me, great, and these complex feelings I had about it, moral feelings.
You say about the movies, they became part of me the way something loved does. And yet, I mean, in some ways, it's clear that you knew that there was a moral contradiction here, I guess, to loving the work and really, disavowing the person that he is.
Exactly. And I think that one of the things that's interesting about the case of Roman Polanski and my thinking about him was it came sort of over a period of years before Me Too. So I've been sort of working on this problem for the last 3 years and thinking about it. And I think a lot of us have. I think we all struggle with these issues of buying, consuming, watching things that we know aren't sort of morally perfect, even like buying an iPhone. You know, it's a complicated process morally if you really think about it. But I was thinking about it sort of in a wilderness by myself because it wasn't foregrounded. So when Me Too came, all of a sudden there was a whole world of people thinking about this same problem.
All right. Let me take a call here from Jean in Minneapolis. Hi, Jean. Interested in how you're working through this. What's it mean
to you?
Good morning,
Terry. Good morning. I think one of the problems is the way that this question is framed. By saying that the art is good and the person is bad, it reflects the media's tendency to flatten the personalities of men who behave this way. They are not one-dimensional. They have bad behavior, but they're not a bad person. Good people do bad things. And so I think we need to recognize that that's a whole person who has some terrible flaws, but there is much more to them, and we need to look at that.
I think, Jean, you've really put your finger on the essence of what we're wrestling with here, Claire.
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. I think that one of the things that happens when we sort of make these people, I mean, what they have done is horrible, and this moment of reckoning, a national or global reckoning with these accusations, I think is a really important historical moment. This shift toward listening to accusations and really hearing the accusers and shifting our belief from the accused to the accuser. It's something like, I'm 51, I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime. At the same time, if we make these guys completely wrong, if we say they're just bad people, which I'll admit I have said, and we call them monsters, which I admit I have done.
And you have,
sort of,
yes.
To simplify the idea, and actually then I sort of drill down into that word.
We might have lost Claire there. Okay. So what we'll do is try to reconnect with Claire, and we'll go to a story now. About actually the very issue that we're talking about here. This is from Morning Edition this morning. The musician R. Kelly has been accused of sexual abuse, child pornography, even running a kind of sex cult, but he's still managed to stay one of the most popular R&B singers in the world. Now the Time's Up movement is circulating an open letter asking the entertainment industry to stop doing business with R. Kelly. NPR's Rachel Martin spoke with Rodney Carmichael, who writes about hip-hop for NPR.
This has been a long time coming, hasn't it?
Yeah, the Me Too movement is helping to elevate this cause that, you know, people have been putting public pressure on R. Kelly for years about this.
Yeah.
But last year, two black women in Atlanta, Kenyette Barnes and Orinike Odeleye, started an online campaign. They hashtagged it Mute R. Kelly.
Uh-huh.
And they successfully got 10 R. Kelly concerts canceled in different cities across the country. Yeah. So, you know, now you have people like Tom Joyner who are joining, which is really big deal because he's a huge syndicated radio host. And he says he's not going to play R. Kelly's music anymore.
Huh. Ava
DuVernay.
Shonda Rhimes.
Shonda Rhimes. Questlove. John Legend. All of these people are signing on in support of this letter and really hoping to gain enough momentum to get R. Kelly's record label and streaming services like Spotify and Apple to stop supporting.
Wow. So has R. Kelly responded to any of this?
Okay. So his lawyer put out a statement calling the campaign unjust and off target. He also calls it the attempted public lynching of a black man. And this is the same language that Bill Cosby's publicist used last week to describe his conviction. And obviously, you know, Clarence Thomas notoriously used same loaded language when he was faced with sexual harassment allegations from Anita Hill back
right.
in the day.
Right, what's that about?
Well, it's not good. You know, it's not the kind of metaphor that should be used in these circumstances. And it really comes at an odd time because just last week, you know, we had a new memorial dedicated in honor of real lynching victims in this country.
Right.
So it really kind of just muddies everything that, you know, these black people have died for and were persecuted for.
I mean, it has to be said, R. Kelly's had a really complicated relationship with his audience, even with people who love him for a long time.
It's been complicated for a long time. R. Kelly has been responsible for so many hits over the last 25 years within R&B and pop. You cannot go to a black family reunion to this day, I know because I went to one last year, without the DJ playing Step in the Name of Love, and it's really awkward.
Yeah.
You know, but there's also a lot of African-Americans who really detest R. Kelly and what they feel like he represents and are hopeful that the public sentiment might finally be starting to turn on him. People are really concerned that his victims have been black women who are not rich or famous. And it feels like it's taken a lot more effort to get people to care about it and pay attention to it because of that.
Right. Because the Me Too movement was so much. We saw so many like high profile white women.
Exactly.
Talking about
exactly.
White abusers. And this is different.
Yeah. I mean, it's also important to note that, you know, right now, this is still just a letter, as important as it is.
Yeah.
He's gotten off in a court of law before. So in terms of justice, the supporters of this campaign are seeking, there might still be a long way to go.
Rodney Carmichael, he writes about hip hop for NPR Music. Hey, Rodney, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
Rachel Martin and Rodney Carmichael, they're actually talking specifically about what we were talking about when we had a few technical difficulties. So we listened to that. We're bringing Claire Dieter back into the conversation. Claire, you there again?
I am here.
Good.
For now.
I heard that piece this morning about R. Kelly, and I thought, this is the essence of what to do about this. You heard Rodney saying, you will hear this at family reunions, you'll hear his music in a lot of clubs. And yet, man, the stuff that he has been accused of, I don't know that I would want to support that art. And I think Alyssa writes about this, too.
Yeah, I think that this is the essence of the problem. I actually loved what he talked about, this idea of when he says that the music is played in clubs, but also more deeply than that, at family reunions.
Right.
This is music that's interwoven into people's lives. You know, it's hearing Ignition or these songs that like that inform your life and that you respond to without even thinking, you know, that are just these, they're part, you have memories of them, you have a relationship with them, and yet they get disrupted by what this person has done. And what I think about is like there's a almost like a terminal quality, like at a certain point you just cannot listen to or view or read the art without thinking of person did.
Right.
And R. Kelly, thanks to the power, I mean, you know, if Shonda Rhimes is going to talk about this and if leaders are going to talk about this and if women are going to lead on this, that's going to make it so that the conversation gets disrupted in a way that's really effective and that changes our thinking around the and our feelings around the art, because what we're really talking about is feelings.
Well, I think that that's the hard part about this, because when you feel known in some ways by the artist, and you may have never, your only experience with that artist might have been in consuming or observing the art. But in some ways, you feel known by that artist. That's a deep thing for your identity, and it's hard to surrender.
Yeah, I think that there's that. I think there's this whole emotional connection we have with artists. And the fact is that a lot of times, artists' job is to go out into the world and bring back sort of dark news. You know, they have to sort of tell us about harder parts of ourselves, which is not necessarily the case with R. Kelly. But, you know, they're sort of charged with this idea of talking about what's difficult. And so maybe difficult people get purchased in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of one piece of it. They're making emotional work we connect to. But another piece of it is when we respond to stuff like R. Kelly or Woody Allen, you know, these are things that it's work that is deeply in our own history. Woody Allen, many of us grew up watching his films. And having his films be important in the same way that R. Kelly's music is interwoven into lives. And when we respond, we tell ourselves we're having ethical thoughts. I'm having this series of ethical thoughts about R. Kelly or Woody Allen, but we're really having moral feelings.
Right.
And this really opened up for me when I was talking to a friend about Woody Allen, and she said, I have so many thoughts about Woody Allen. And then she said, I'm furious at him. And I thought, that's the essence of the problem. That's not a thought. That's a feeling.
Right. Claire Dieter is with us here as we contemplate what to do about the art, the movies, the books, the televisions made, the music made by people who have been accused and or admitted to sexual harassment and assault. And I'm asking you, now, how are you feeling about Bill Cosby's early comedy? It was really meaningful. As Claire says, it's a part of our history. Kevin Spacey's movies. One of my favorite movies is The Usual Suspects. The work of Russell Simmons. Sherman Alexie, whose poetry I absolutely love. Charlie Rose, etc. So Claire and I are talking about this. Alyssa Rosenberg is going to join us here in just a couple of minutes. And I want to know what you think about this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, where a listener says, it's hard depending on the person and how much I enjoy the work. I avoid financially supporting problematic artists. Here's John who says, movies depends on how close to the final product they were. Producers, I don't care. Directors like Woody Allen or Polanski, gross and no. To the phones to Dee in Edina. Hi, Dee. Thanks for waiting. What are you thinking?
Well, good morning, and thank you so much for the thoughtful conversation on this topic. I think it's really important. To me, it really matters how the man chooses how to respond to the allegations against him. I'm a survivor of domestic violence and sexual assault, and my abuser chose to call me a liar when I finally told my story. And when I see the entertainment industry deny their accusations and call their accusers liars, I really want nothing to do with them and their art, and I have a hard time even looking at them. However, someone like Louis C.K., who acknowledges he made mistakes and apologizes right away, is somewhat someone that I'll continue to watch.
That's interesting because, Dee, I mean, Louis C.K. said, the power I had over these women is that they admired me and I wielded that power irresponsibly. He hasn't really, I guess, been specific about, with direct apologies to the women that he demeaned and degraded with this. Does that change it for you, Dee?
Yeah, and he acknowledged the more subtle aspects of that power, you know, there, and that is different to me, much different than someone who is being accused of rape and says, nope, I didn't do it. That didn't happen. She's a liar. She's making it up.
Claire, what do you think?
Well, there's been a really important story about this that's kind of gone a little bit under the radar. Dan Harmon, who is a sort of comedy world recognized genius, who made the series Community and also made the show Rick and Morty, which is this sort of brilliant, weird show. He has been accused of sexual harassment by one of his writers. And she... And it took this form that is more passive-aggressive, where he told her he was in love with her and sort of made her life difficult as a writer. And she started, I believe, I could have the series of events here wrong, but she started a Twitter campaign talking about this. He made a statement on to the public on a podcast where he started to talk about what he had done. So instead of just apologizing, which he did, he also enumerated his sort of, you know, instances of bad behavior and described them back to her, which is actually sort of an interesting new criminal justice approach. This idea of having the accused person or the convicted person say back what they have done.
Yes.
So it acknowledges to the victim, I know this happened. And it's being, this Dan Harmon thing is being cited as an instance of a way for artists to actually engage with these accusations.
Super interesting, because a number of the people who have been accused have said, well, I don't remember it that way, or I might have done those three things, but I didn't do the other six that you say I did.
Right, exactly. I think that that acknowledgement of reality, which is so important for any accuser, to have the accused or anybody in their world say, yes, I believe you, this happened. Dan Harmon stepped in, not that he's a hero. You know, that's, I'm not meaning to lift somebody who is accused of this. But it is a model of how people who are accused can respond. And I will add, sidebar, I have a 16-year-old son, and he's the person who brought this Dan Harmon story to me.
Okay. So he's, so he, and that's a good, I think that's a really good thing that your son at that age is aware of this, right? And all the different dimensions of the way people are going to respond to it. Have you talked about this with him?
Yeah, I think that this is actually, I do think this is an incredibly important moment. As I said earlier, I think it's an historic moment where women are coming forward. And one of the, and the most important thing is that people find justice and that we switch our belief, at least, we switch our belief to the accusers, I think is just this incredible dynamic. But a side effect is I get to talk to a young man about this almost every day. And yeah, he gets bored of it. he doesn't always want to talk about it. But these stories coming out give me a way to talk to my son about these issues. So it's about what's happening out there and his choices about what he's going to support. But it's also about his choices about how he's going to be and act.
Jenny says on Twitter, I struggle with this. I will not purchase things supporting those artists. I also have found that I can't watch, read, or listen to their art without it being tainted. My enjoyment is tied to a feeling of guilt. I shouldn't like something made by an abuser. And here's something else interesting, Claire, from Layla, who called in to say, what disturbs me the most about predators, when you look back at their art, it's inspired by their life experience. I find it disturbing knowing those connections. You must be looking for that as you've been researching Polanski.
Yeah, I am looking for that as I research Polanski. And it's much more cut and dried when you look at Woody Allen. I'll be honest. Like, if you look at Woody Allen, there's the example of Manhattan.
Right.
And there's his... So Manhattan, for listeners who don't really know the film, was a film he made in the early 80s about a character, played by Woody Allen, who has a relationship with a high school student. And in the opening... Like, a sexual relationship. And in the opening scene, the main character is taking the high school student out to dinner with some of his other 40-something friends, mm-hmm. a couple, and it's just no big deal. Everybody's accepting it. So there's a cultural and historical piece where that was more normal when I was young as well, or if not normal, at least accepted among overeducated people.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see Woody Allen wrestling with the actual theme on the screen. With Polanski, it's much murkier. He's constantly in his films. It's much more sort of a film critical way of looking at it, where you see issues of power and men dominating women and women trying to find their freedom. And the shocking thing with Polanski is how often the films themselves, their sympathy falls on the side of the women.
And what's that about, do you think?
I think that... this is a bold statement, but I think a great artist really is informed by some kind of humanism.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something he's working out about dominance and women mm-hmm. on the screen, and mm-hmm. he's also identifying with the victim. Also, Polanski's wow. parents were both victims of the Holocaust, and Polanski, spent his young life on the run from the Nazis. And so he comes out of a history of having been victimized himself, and then, of course, his wife was murdered. So it's very complicated.
Call here from Alex in St. Cloud. Alex, how are you looking at this?
I'm looking at this through the lens of specifically the abilities of the artist, and more so of how I respect different artists or even athletes. I respect them for their acting or their athletic ability and not so much their moral or their personal choices. I know them for their art, for what they're known for.
Claire, what do you think of that?
I actually really identify with this caller more. As somebody who is completely concerned with victims' rights and wanting to hear alternative voices, and I'm really identified with this moment on the one hand, but on the other hand, I completely feel what this guy is saying. When somebody is excellent at something, we want to connect with what they're excellent at. And I guess my question is, when you see somebody who's a great athlete who's been accused, does that burble in your brain?
Yeah. Well, Alex, are you still there?
Yep.
Does it?
To some degree, it does, yes.
Happens then?
Yeah. What do you do with that? You can't really unknow it.
Right. I think that I try and focus on what they're known best for and kind of their abilities in that sense.
Hmm. He can compartmentalize better than I can, because I can't. It overrides and really influences the way I experience the art. Listen to this, Claire. This kind of goes to this. Listener says, I can appreciate the art someone like Louis C.K. makes and have my protest be in the form of not purchasing their products. But every time I watch a comedy routine, whenever he comes back, by Louis C.K., what he did, and I'm telling you the details of what he did, are really degrading.
Mm-hmm.
I can't forget that, and I don't want to forget it.
I think it's really hard to answer the caller's question without being gendered. Mm. You know, the fact is that most women have experienced one of these things, harassment, assault, rape. Not every woman, but I mean, the numbers tell us that this is something that, many, many, many women have experienced. And so I think that when that's your experience, it's much harder and more complex to compartmentalize. And I speak as someone who does compartmentalize. Like, I will still watch a Polanski film. And no one, I have had experiences not as extreme as what he did to his victim. But the reason I became fascinated with his story was because of my own experience of molestation and assault.
Mm.
And yet, I can still experience the greatness of the work. And where I really go with this whole discussion is toward an individual responsibility of the audience to say these emotions are real,
mm-hmm.
You know, these responses are real, but we also really need the art to bring us this news of, you know, the subconscious and some kind of mental landscape that these great artists do have access to.
Right.
I mean, Hemingway was just a nightmare, and yet do we give up his books? I mean, I just can't buy it.
Yeah, I don't want to give up that sense of belonging. I think that's how you put it, Claire, in one of your pieces about the thing. That is what really exceptional art does. Here, this is intriguing here from Anna on Twitter. She says, rather than specifically avoiding those artists, I've been striving to choose works by women, especially women of color. In an age where we've basically unlimited access to books and music and movies,
mm-hmm.
there's no reason to limit your perspective. I think Vanessa wants to chime in on that. Hey,
yeah.
Vanessa, hi.
I love this. Hi there.
Hi. Are you thinking about that too, seeking out work by women? Yeah.
Yeah, I've totally gone in the other direction, because you would never have to watch a movie or listen to a song or read a novel by a problematic artist if you just looked for women. And part of, I feel, the Me Too movement is not just about hearing stories of sexual assault and other horrible things, but turning to women's voices in
good.
Media
really
and
good.
Really seeking that out instead.
Exactly. Absolutely. Claire, yes?
I love that point of view. I'm actually, you know, this is something that's a big part of my life, like as a teacher and as a writer, supporting other women's voices. And I actually think the point that Rodney made at the top of the hour
mm-hmm.
about the voices of women of color, like those are even sort of more suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
This is this opportunity to talk about what voices have been lost and how we can elevate them. Whether that's as people, you know, really as people who are buying and consuming culture, I think that's sort of the future, is for us to really reflect on, not as a chore, not as something I ought to do, but engaging with the idea that there's this whole world of work out there that does reflect human experience. I think that when I think about this problem, I sort of drill down into the problem of it. But
yeah.
when I think about the solution or what feels like moving forward, it's exactly what the caller said.
And it does feel more hopeful than I
mm-hmm.
thought it would. That's true. Chris says on Twitter, this is complex. I think it's possible to dislike or even hate an artist, but not discount or ignore their art. We don't know, but there's enough to indicate that Beethoven, Liszt, Van Gogh
mm-hmm.
all may have had some unsavory things in their history. I want to get a look at the latest news here. And when we come back, talk with Claire about something that A.O. Scott brought up in this piece about Woody Allen. He says, this habit of treating artists as transcendent creators rather than as players in an economic system protects them in some ways from expectations. So I want to talk about that as well and hear more of your thoughts on what you're doing with this moment in the Me Too movement, what we do with the art that gives us a sense of resonance, of belonging that we love, that we want to continue to experience from artists who sexual assault, have been predators, have been criminals, have been harassers. How do we deal with it? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Again, I will try to get to as many of your comments on Twitter. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Back to the conversation now. Alyssa Rosenberg joining us. She's opinion writer for The Washington Post. Alyssa, I understand it's been a trying morning. I'm so glad you're able to join us. Welcome.
Thanks for your patience.
We've covered a lot of ground here, but I continue to hear from, Claire and I have been hearing from people who are saying, well, here's the distinction I make about the art and the artist. I might consume their art, but I don't buy their work anymore. I don't fund them. And I was reading a piece that you wrote about R. Kelly, and actually there was a story on Morning Edition about this, and you said, it's one thing to consume the art of people you profoundly disagree with. It's another to know when you simply don't want to fund someone's life anymore, even at the tiniest level. It's worth knowing the difference. So talk to me about that difference.
So I've written about this on and off for years because it's a subject that comes up over and over again. And this flared up in particular when the movie adaptation of Ender's Game was coming out.
Right.
Orson Scott Card, who wrote the original novel, what has a lot of profoundly anti-gay beliefs. And people were asking me, you know, is it okay to pirate the movie so I don't give him money? You know, what do I do when I disagree? And At the time, I suggested a system of what I sort of called moral offsets, where you pay for the work because, especially with a movie adaptation or something like that, the money isn't going 100% to the artist. There are a lot of other people who worked on it. And I also just think, in general, I'm not pro-stealing to make a political point.
Yeah.
So I said, buy the ticket, buy the album, buy the book, whatever, donate the equivalent value to a charity that offsets what you think the person's views are. With someone like R. Kelly, for me, I feel like he is someone who is allegedly running an ongoing abusive sex cult. And to me, there's no amount of money you can give, there's no charity that you can give it to that offsets even a penny of profit going to support an ongoing wrong like that, an ongoing alleged wrong, I should say, to be absolutely clear, since, you know, legal distinctions. So I think that a lot of this is a case-by-case basis, right? I mean, if you decide that buying a Bill Cosby box set is going to fund his legal appeals and you just don't want to be involved in that, I think you're better off just not spending the money, right? I think pirating it or stealing it is sort of a way to have your cake and eat it too, but it's not really a much more moral decision than saying, you know
right.
what, if I cannot stand for any of my money to go to this, I'm just going to let it go.
Well, Alyssa, let me ask you this then. Sometimes I think about, if I buy the book of the harasser or assaulter mid-career, I'm just giving a signal to the person that publishes him, to the Hollywood studio that allows them to make the movie, that he's still viable economically. So even if I'm donating to a charity, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, if you feel that way, then just don't buy it. I mean, I think there's not a workaround here. If you really feel like, you know, buying a book, a movie ticket is a sign of moral approval, then you can't.
Yeah.
Do a workaround.
It is hard.
Because
to be honest with you, I don't feel that way, which might be because I just want to keep consuming the art. But Claire, you have a thought on this?
Oh, no. I guess I just was wanting to ask Alyssa. So do you think that there's a kind of qualitative difference between buying the work of a rapist, accuser, harasser who's alive versus someone who's dead?
I mean, I think if they're dead, they're dead. You know, it's moral disapproval of a dead person doesn't necessarily matter very much to them. I think that thinking critically and talking critically about the interactions between someone's behavior and their work is always a useful thing. You know, I think Cosby is a really interesting example because I don't know how many of you have read Wesley Morris's sort of great essay about Cliff Huxtable being sort of the sick joke in the disguise that Cosby used.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that there, even if the art and the artist are not the same entity, there can be some interaction there. Artists can sort of use their art to launder their personas. But if someone's dead, there's not a lot that you can do to punish them. You know, we can get into whether it's wise or appropriate to sort of visit the sins of the father down on however many successive generations
estate.
And the estate,
exactly.
et cetera. But to me, that's not sort of terrible.
Well, I think that you brought up this idea of buying or not buying the work as an expression of your moral feeling to the market, right? So if I'm going to say, you mentioned a mid-career artist, and that you would stop buying their work as a way to show the person who is publishing or producing their work that it was not acceptable to you. And we sort of don't have that relationship with, like, Wagner or Gauguin or somebody who's long dead.
I don't think I necessarily said that. I mean, I think that this is me sort of responding to readers and trying to give them strategies. To me, there are situations where I just can't stand to give any of my money to someone.
As with R. Kelly.
Because I think that, right, because that money is facilitating the commission of an ongoing wrong.
Right, which has to do with that person being, I just think that distinction is really interesting, that the person is alive and perhaps perpetrating.
Here's Shannon on Twitter who says, if we continue to support the harassers financially, are they going to suffer any consequences? When people are sexually harassed, they leave opportunities. They change courses in their lives. Their harassers get to continue on in their lives. The wallet is our biggest punchback. And then here's Josh who says, everyone is their best and worst self every day, all the time. There's nothing simple about any human. Follow Bishop Tutu's lead. Don't hide and compartmentalize what is true. Acknowledge the truth and move on. Artists are flawed, complicated, and not even close to perfect. Claire, I think you picked up on the gender approach to this, and I'm glad you did, because I'm definitely seeing that on Twitter, different reactions to this. Let me grab a call from Ashley in Hopkins. Hey, Ashley, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is a great conversation. I just want to mention, and is it Alyssa kind of commented on it, if we're still providing money for their work, then they're continuing to do that. But if there's this, some sort of, like, almost dethroning where they redeem themselves or apologize and kind of move on from that, I think then we can, from there, start to build them back up if they are going to change their ways or, you know, redeem themselves.
Okay, so Alyssa,
if I can jump in for a second.
Yeah, before you got here, Claire and I were talking about how important the apology is. So
well,
go ahead.
Well, the acknowledgement, we were talking about the Dan Harmon example,
right,
where he enumerated exactly what happened. So it's not just an apology, it's an iteration of the victim's accusations.
Right.
And I hate the word victim.
Absolutely.
Carry on.
And I think this is a really fascinating and important question, because in that case, you know, you had a specific person who had stepped forward, had asked for something, and sort of had it within her power to accept Harmon's apology and grant forgiveness, right? And not everything is going to work that way. If you have someone who is an accused serial sexual assaulter, accused serial sexual harasser, the question of who gets to grant forgiveness and whether or not, you know, if one of Harvey Weinstein's accusers says that she forgives him, does that mean the rest of us should? Does that mean that there shouldn't be a legal process?
I
think that
I also think it has to do with the kind of cultural, social, economic capital of the accuser. I really like what you said, Alyssa. It's like, we're talking about R. Kelly a lot this week. One of the issues here is that these women do not have the same cultural capital as one of Dan Harmon's writers or one of Harvey Weinstein's accusers. And this is really important.
Absolutely.
Who's doing the accusing?
Well, and this is also just an argument for why we so desperately need the legal system to work in these cases. I think something that undergirds so many of our conversations about sexual harassment and sexual assault is the assumption that the legal system just isn't going to work. Rape kits aren't going to get tested. accused sexual harassers and sexual assaulters are not going to be charged or brought to trial. If they are, they're not going to be convicted. And so we're looking for all of these systems of workarounds, whether we're holding people civilly liable, whether we're talking about boycotts. And if the legal system worked the way it was supposed to, I think that we might have a more clear-cut sort of set of stations that we could go through socially to figure out, you know, what's an appropriate punishment, when has someone served that punishment, how do we decide if they've learned something from that punishment, and under what circumstances do we forgive them. I think one of the things that made Cosby's conviction such a big moment was this sense that, oh my God, the legal system worked the way it was supposed to, right? I mean,
well,
this is someone who's been accused.
Sorry, go ahead. The legal system was affected by a Hearts and Minds campaign. I mean, that was what was huge, was he wasn't convicted before Me Too. He was convicted after Me Too. Oh, my God, what does this mean legally?
Here's Mallory, who says,
it's a really interesting question.
I'm heartbroken over Al Franken and Louis C.K. Now, this throws another interesting element into this. Both have done a lot to further women in their careers, and that is true. Louis C.K. has supported the careers of women comedians, and Senator Al Franken supported and authored a lot of legislation, or some legislation that was valuable to women. And then Mallory goes on and she says, and I feel like Al was a great senator and Louis addressed important topics in his works. What they did was wrong, but I still admire them. This is kind of where we began, Claire, with a listener calling in and saying, you have to think of this with some dimension to it. People are not all bad. They're human and flawed.
Alyssa, well, and I think that goes, I mean, I live in near Seattle, and so, of course, the Sherman Alexie thing has really hit home for me. And you mentioned that it was something that was really important to you because you love his work.
Right.
And I think that one of the things about Sherman Alexie is he's been accused of taking advantage of women he helped.
That's right.
But the end of the, I mean, not but, and the end of that sentence is he helped. So it's complex. Like, I'm reading right now the memoir Heartberries, which is a really important new memoir.
Therese Myatt, yes.
Oh, it's such a beautiful book, and it's such an important book about race and gender and the Indian or the Native experience, the Indigenous experience. He was a huge supporter of this book.
Right.
And yet, women who are also Indigenous women have accused him of both supporting them and exploiting them. So I think this idea of artists that hold women up and yet also exploit is sort of embodied in Sherman Alexie, and he's supported my own work. So it's complicated.
Alyssa, do you have a thought on that?
And Harvey Weinstein.
Well,
yeah, I mean, I think that one of the really valuable lessons of Me Too and this moment in general is that we just may not get to a place where this stuff is clear-cut or clean, or where there is a mathematical formula that we can plug the facts of someone's life into and it'll spit out a calculation that says this person is worth tolerating, this person is not. You know, the good that many of these men have done is in some cases intimately connected to the horrible things that they did, right?
Exactly.
And if Harvey Weinstein didn't have a reputation for coming up with great roles for actresses, he would not have had access to so many of them in the first place.
Right, and when someone's image disrupts, when their image is disrupted by their actions, as with Cosby, or, you know, that's where we get uncomfortable. Sorry, go on with that.
I don't think we're going to get to a place where everything feels clean and neatly resolved. I think we're going to have to live with a lot of conflict and ambiguity, and that's something that we are really, really terrible about right now. We are in this moment of sort of extreme demands for ideological purity and, you know, sort of perfect behavior. And that's not to say that complexity becomes an excuse. You know, it's not.
Right.
But better to be here than not be here.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do. There is nothing you can plug into an equation that makes it okay that you raped somebody, right?
I actually had this thought like a month ago. What if you made a website that was a calculator and you would put in how bad the crime was and how good the work was, and it would spew out whether or not you could watch the film or read the book, right? Because that's what everyone craves. Like, I've written extensively on this, and what I come back to over and over is each viewer or reader has to do a calculus of emotion, thought, their own experience, and really kind of inventory that. And yet whenever I wrote this piece for the Paris Review about this, and I ended up going on the radio and talking to a ton of people about it, and everybody just wanted to know what to do. They wanted to be told. You know, it's like my whole point is you're going to have to do this yourself.
Because of what we said at the beginning, Claire, about your own relationship to that individual art is something that you can't stick into the calculator and spew out. Yeah.
We need to be moral actors here, and it's easier to outsource morality than it is to practice it on our own.
And I will say that I think the outsourcing of morality is one of the reasons that we're in hot water as a culture.
Meaning
that we sort of, the idea of the hot take and someone telling you what to think and being responsive all the time and constantly wanting to sort of, like the constant flow of think pieces and everyone knowing what you ought to think, which Alyssa kind of touched on, it disrupts the fact that these processes are subtle. And I loved what the conversation at the beginning about R. Kelly and the conversation about how he's woven into the fabric of family reunions. You don't get to just sort of make a moral decision about that. You can't remove that art from people's experience. It doesn't mean they need to keep consuming it at all. But
let me grab another caller here who I think is really pertinent to what we're talking about, to Christar in St. Cloud. Hey, Christar, thanks so much for waiting.
Sure, it's Christar. But thanks. I think what we have to look at is the utility of the teaching moment here, mm-hmm. and their issues of fairness and justice. And we're getting notice of a new standard, and I can speak from the perspective of a 52-year-old man, that this is good. These are good conversations. The thing I would say about Polanski is, what is the continuing lesson for our children about Polanski? You can skip the country and skip the possible trial, and as long as you create great work, you will never be accountable. Or Adrian Peterson, if you're a great running back, if you take a switch to your 4-year-old child, you will never see the consequences of that because you're a great athlete. And I think we really ought to be careful about people that never pay the price for their bad acts, never take corrective action. And we really have to put some heavy weight into that, in my opinion.
Claire, Claire, do you want to address that specifically, what he was saying about Roman Polanski?
My first question is, my main question is, what does that heavy weight look like for you, for the caller?
Christar?
If he would come back to the United States and face those charges, I think that would be a great lesson to say, okay, I'm accused of this, I'm prepared to pay the price for this crime and have this fairness and justice issue addressed, and then maybe go on to continue to work.
But that would change, Christar, your experience of his work and the moral questions you'd ask about the work?
It does. Huh. It does. To oversimplify it, it's the same with Adrian Peterson. He's a great running back. But once he did those bad acts and didn't seem to be very contrite about it, mm-hmm. that changed my opinion. It changed my feeling of whether he should be on the Minnesota team or not. And no matter how great the artist is, of course, I'm talking about living people where corrective action can be taken.
Yeah.
I think we have to provide that lesson to our children that you can't be the greatest person in the world and have no rules apply to you.
Alyssa, maybe you want a thought on this. I'm not sure contrition, Claire and I talked a bit about this at the beginning, is enough either for me about how I'm going to experience their art in the future. How are you dealing with that?
It's really case by case, right? I go back and look at Louis, which is a great television show, and I read it differently, but I don't know that I stop loving things. I'm trying to sit with a lot of my complexity right now rather than trying to resolve it. And
exactly.
I think, you know, being in places that make us uncomfortable might be good for a lot of us right now.
Claire, you're working on a book about what you call monstrous men and their art. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Oh, How's that going?
Well, right now I'm very deep in a chapter of what it constitutes to be, what constitutes a monstrous woman, which is a much more problematic issue and maybe for another day. So
super
it's
fascinating.
Difficult. It's, you know, it's taking me into exactly what Alyssa just said, this quality of sitting with complexity. Because my book is not just dealing with living artists where we're in dynamic with them, and as the caller said, sort of modeling these choices for our children and these repercussions and what is it, natural consequences, like we try to teach our children.
Claire, forgive me, I have to interrupt. We are out of time. Come back. Alyssa, thank you.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.